This is a Triple J podcast.
I think people often mistake healing as you've stopped struggling, and that's just not the case.
Hey, Dee here. Really big ep for you today. It's with someone I deeply admire and have wanted to chat to on the Hookup podcast for a while now. Someone who I think there's so much to learn from. His name is Harrison James, and he is a child sexual abuse survivor, an award-winning activist, and co-founder of the hashtag Your Reference Ain't Relevant campaign. Basically, Harry is behind this incredible activism that has fueled legislative reform across multiple Australian jurisdictions, including recently in New South Wales, where good character references were abolished for convicted offenders of all sexual violence offences. And also, Harrison has just released his debut book, Transform Your Pain into Purpose, where he talks about his story being a 13-year-old boy who was sexually abused, manipulated, and coerced by his stepmom for years, who then also gave birth to his daughter. He was forced to keep the abuse and the fact that the baby was his a secret and had to pretend that it was his sister. So just a bit of a heads up, we are going to talk about sexual abuse, sexual assault, and domestic violence in this episode, but we've got some really helpful resources in the show notes if this episode brings up anything for you as well. But, you know, this episode also has a lot of hope and inspiration and excitement. And Harry chats about his journey of healing and finding love with his now fiance, Bella, who you're also going to hear from. So really excited to get into this chat. Let's do it. Harrison, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you have an incredible career of advocacy. You are such an amazing voice for victims and survivors of child sexual abuse. It has been so inspiring to watch. And like I said in my intro, I have been wanting to chat to you for a long time. So I'm really excited to chat to you today. Can you talk us through a little bit about where your journey began?
Yeah, for sure. So after experiencing sexual abuse as a child from the ages of 13 to 16 and heading to a mental health facility, that's sort of where things started to change for me. And I saw Grace Tame become Australia of the Year. And that sort of instilled this confidence in me to pursue advocacy. And I had this sort of niggling, like this chip on my shoulder about the idea of good character references being used as a mitigating factor in sentencing. And that sort of propelled me to diving into the world of advocacy, and it was complex. And I think along the entire journey, it was just a constant learning experience. It still is to this day, even after securing legislative wins across the country. It still is a learning experience. And yeah, it's just been it, but it has been rewarding and healing. Like my perpetrator, my stepmother, didn't go to court, so I didn't garner justice in the traditional sort of sense. But to be able to campaign and advocate and help other people along the way, that has been my form of justice. And it's been really beautiful to see that come to fruition.
And a huge congratulations, because it recently changed in New South Wales, right?
Yeah, so we've passed the law in four jurisdictions. So New South Wales, the ACT, Victoria has made a commitment to introduce legislation this year, and Tasmania has done the same. So four out of the eight jurisdictions of Australia.
It's so huge and so incredibly, I can imagine, rewarding. You talk about in your book the fact that you, through your experience of, you know, child sexual abuse, you felt that you were coerced into being silent about that,
yeah.
Right? But there was a pivotal moment where you decided to come public with your story. What was that moment like for you?
Yeah, it was a surge of, I think, multiple emotions at one thing. I can't really concentrate it to one feeling or anything like that, but there was just this urgency to do something with it. And I think I came to the understanding that what happened to me was not my fault, but it was my responsibility to do something with it and not let it fester. And yeah, this whole idea of breaking a cycle and stuff like that, I don't know what struck me with it, but I had the foresight to want to sort it out early in my life. This was around the time where I was 20, 21, 22. I'm 26 now. I'm still working on these things and, you know, still picking up different techniques and leaning on different support networks to be able to heal through it. But I feel as though I have garnered the tools to be able to manage, you know, when triggers arise and stuff like that, which is a wonderful thing. So, yeah, but to get back to your question, when I was had that first opportunity to speak out publicly, it was like a tea kettle going off. Like it was just the steam had to come out and there had to be some release. And for me to be able to film myself and put it on social media and have an impact, that was just sort of the most immediate action I could take to feel some sort of response. Because the thing about abuse and trauma, Dee, and you articulate it really beautifully in your book as well, it's that how isolating it is and the shame that encapsulates you. And I felt so alone during that period, and I just needed to establish some connection in some way. And as I said, there was this sense of urgency I possessed, and that filming that video and putting it on social media was just the first thing that I could do.
What happened after?
Yeah, there was a big response, and lots of people came forward and said, I've been through something similar. I've never seen a young guy talk about anything like this. And there was obviously awful comments as well, but the positive ones outweighed those negative ones. And then obviously from a behind the scenes perspective in real life, not on social media, you know, my father wasn't happy about me speaking out and didn't enjoy that part of it, because he was actually being held accountable in some way, as well as my stepmother. But yeah, it just reinforced the idea within me that I did the right thing. And by speaking out, it's sort of, you know what it's like to bottle something up and not have a release for it. And that was my release, to be able to speak about it. And for so many people to respond to it in such a positive way just reinforced that idea that I said before, that it was not my fault what I went through. But yeah, it also instilled or ignited that passion to want to do something with it as well. And that's why it led to the advocacy campaign. And before I even launched a campaign, I spent a year navigating the system and meeting people and attending like rallies and protests and all those things to be able to garner connections within the system to be able to establish the best course of action for the campaigning. So it was really measured, and it wasn't like I just woke up one day and had this grand idea and it became reality. It was a gradual process to get to that point.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, people maybe listening would really understand that, right? It's like so many experiences throughout the years build up to a point where you do potentially tell someone for the first time, because we know that so many people don't, you know, they live with that abuse inside them and in secrecy and don't share it.
But that's what isolation does. It makes you feel like you're alone. That's what shame does, pardon me. It makes you feel like you're alone and you can't escape it. But yeah, as I was saying, it wasn't like a film or like, you know, a monologue or anything like that. It wasn't this sweeping thing. It was these intentional, deliberate, small, tiny changes over an extended period of time that got me to a point where I was ready to do that.
You talked in the book about the fact that, and you mentioned there, like you got comments, and you still do to this day when you share your story, that men, quote unquote, always want sex, right?
Yeah.
That like what you experienced wasn't abuse, because men should always, I guess, just like enjoy it. How have you found that kind of conversation? Because I can imagine it's obviously going to be quite gendered.
Yeah, well, it's two-pronged, I think, because I think society has groomed men to feel as though that any form of sexual advance, whether it is abusive or not, is the ultimate form of social currency. And in the book, I speak through that specifically with everything that happened around Bonnie Blue coming to Queensland. I'm not sure, was that discussed on the show at any point?
I don't think we did, but we posted about it on Instagram.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there you go. Well, yeah, for those that don't know, Bonnie Blue was an OnlyFans star who came from England to Australia to prey on barely legal boys at schoolies. My point there was that these boys have been groomed because of society and, you know, online pornography to make them feel as though any sexual advance is, you know, makes them feel like they're the king of the world. And I talked about my experience when my stepmother sexually abused me, and I was a 13, 14, 15 year old kid. And I felt as though I couldn't say anything, because this is every teenage boy's fantasy. You know, you see it online and in the magazines where porn categories like stepmom and teen. And there's nothing wrong with anyone wanting to engage with, you know, the porn industry. I'm not here to shame anyone in that regard. But I do think there is an issue with the sort of dynamic that it presents people, and how boys and men who are susceptible to that, and women as well, feel as though they need to play out those gendered sort of stereotypes and narratives in their everyday lives. And it's incredibly damaging. I mean, I get comments all the time saying, oh, you're so lucky, you killed it, like you're the king of the world. And I think part of my role as an advocate and, you know, a survivor of child sexual abuse who speaks out and sort of I hope I use my platform to change mindsets. But that is something I speak on regularly because I know how damaging it is, and I know that it stifles young boys in feeling as though they can't speak out when something bad's happened.
Absolutely. You have absolutely done that and done such an incredible job. And you talk about it as well in the book with the friendships you've been able to make through the work that you do with other men who talk about their experiences. I do want to talk about your healing journey, though, because I found that one of the most beautiful parts of the book, like some of the things that you write about, is like writing an unsent letter. And I found that really valuable. I was like, okay, I'm going to go write this unsent letter. That's something that I really wanted to do. Yeah, tell us a little bit about like what some of the things that have worked for you when you did start to go through that process of like after coming out publicly and starting to figure out ways that did heal parts of you.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I have to reciprocate it because I garnered a lot of expertise from your book as well. But yeah, for a long time, I thought healing was like something that you arrived at. And I imagined that there'd be this day where I'd wake up and be like, yep, I'm healed, all good. But really, healing isn't a destination. It's this constant, you know, choosing these deliberate things to be able to rebuild that relationship with yourself. And I think people often mistake healing as you've stopped struggling. And that's just not the case. I don't think that's true at all. You know, I still have moments where trauma overtakes all the work that I've done within myself. And, you know, trauma sets a trap and shame sets a trap. And sometimes I do take the bait. But because of the wonderful support I have around me now in, you know, my beautiful partner, Bella, my mother, my grandmother, my family, I don't take that bait. The difference now is that I just don't stay in that. And I'm able to find my way back to myself a little bit quicker now. And I think that's what healing is. It's not about arriving at an endpoint. It's simply about garnering the tools to be able to manage these issues when they arise and those triggers and find your way back to yourself when life gets inevitably hard again. And to answer your question about the healing from unsent letters, that was one of my favorite chapters to write because it's such a profound therapeutic practice to be able to write a letter where no one else is probably going to see it and it's just you and the page, and you have a goal of getting everything that you felt as though you couldn't say out on the page, and it's not going to reach them ever. So there's just this freedom in being able to do that. And I think when you've been so traumatized for so much of your life, the opposite of trauma isn't happiness, the opposite of trauma is freedom. And being able to sort of let go of those chains that have shackled you down for so long. And the practice of healing through unsent letters is just an opportunity to do that, to direct your anger and your shame at the person who may have inflicted it on you. Or, as I say in the book, it's not just for survivors of sexual abuse. It might be, you know, if you're a woman who goes to a meeting at work and your boss constantly shuts you down, you might want to say something to him. If you're at the gym and there's this one seedy guy in the corner who always catcalls you or something, you might want to say something towards him. But if you say it directly in the moment, you might fear there's a sense of retaliation. So just being able to sit down and write that letter, it's cathartic. You're able to let go of that weight on your chest. And I still read my letter that I wrote to my stepmother and father from time to time.
There's also finding community, which is something that you talk about. For people listening who maybe haven't come forward with their story and maybe don't feel quite ready to do that yet, what's your advice to them about being able to still find ways to find that community or to find ways of healing slowly?
Well, people who haven't spoken out and don't feel ready to yet, I think there's this narrative that we see in the world now where people feel as though they have to speak out. That's not the case. And I don't want to de-incentivize anyone from speaking out, because when you do, it's an incredibly powerful thing. But survivors and people who have experienced sexual abuse, we're not a homogenous group. You can, you know, choose your path however you see fit. So, you know, when people see victim survivors speaking out and doing radio interviews like this and writing books and changing laws, and like it all seems well and grand, and like I've, you know, reclaimed everything that was done wrong to me, and have instilled this sense of autonomy in myself. And while that may be true, it doesn't solve all the issues that I still face on a daily basis. And I don't think that anyone out there should look to people advocating publicly as the one and only example that they need to end up like. I just think that's unrealistic and also not fair on individuals to make their own choices, especially people who have been subjected to incredibly damaging and life-altering harm. I think all I ever wanted was to regain a sense of autonomy, and I've done that with my work, but no one else has to feel as though they need to do that in order to be deemed worthy of being a survivor. If you choose a different path than I have, what you've experienced, it didn't happen in vain, is what I'm trying to say. You know, yeah. It's everyone can find their own path and go about however they heal. It's totally up to everyone's own definition, what their purpose is. And we're all trying to seek that out, but it's totally up to you on how to define it, and you can regain that sense of autonomy within you.
Yeah. And like, it doesn't necessarily have to be advocacy, right? Like, that's obviously important and a huge part of your book, but a huge part of your book is also being authentic and finding ways to have, for you especially, you talk about it towards the end of the book, normalcy.
Yeah.
Like, you just want a normal life. You just want to be able to be a dad and be a husband and be a partner and be a good friend and to show up in your life, just living a normal life, right?
Yeah.
And being able to experience a lot of the things that you weren't able to when you were growing up. Let's talk about that now, because a huge part of that is your relationship with your partner, Bella.
Yes.
We've actually got Bella here in the studio, Bella.
Hi, guys.
Hi. You are actually being a superhuman because you were pregnant, which we're going to talk about. So thank you for actually being here and agreeing to jump on the mic at the last minute. I was like, do you know what? This actually makes a lot of sense to talk about your relationship while you're here. So tell us a little bit about how you guys met.
It all started in the DMs, which I think is really great. I'm a bit of a serial DM slider, and not necessarily just like in a sexual, creepy way. And because I know that when I receive really lovely DMs, like, I keep a little folder on my phone of like nice things that people say to me. And I'm like, it's so beautiful. So, and also like, there's a lack of connection in the world right now, and I always try to foster connection. But with Harry, I actually just was being sexual and creepy.
So. That was actually. So you obviously knew that what his work was, right?
Yeah. Well, I had read some trashy article in some trashy newspaper that I won't name about, I think he was a cricket player, and he had raped two women. And then, you know, they had included the character references in the article. And I was like, this is disgusting. The guy's been found guilty. And I posted it on my stories and was like, what the hell? And one of my girlfriend's partners actually DM'd me and was like, oh, you should check out Harrison James. Like, you'd really get around his campaign. Got around them more than he's just his campaign.
I love that.
When I got the first message from Belle, saying, oh, you know, like,
it was nice.
It was lovely.
I didn't send him like a fire emoji.
No. But it was very sort of neutral, wasn't it, Del?
I was just testing the waters.
Yeah, and I just sort of went, oh, you know, and because of my position as an activist online, I never sort of use social media to flirt or interact and date in that way.
He's a respectful king.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you're like, I don't want to cross any boundaries talking about.
Yeah. You know, but also, I just didn't gauge that I was potentially being hit on.
Oh, you know, I shoot some shots. And so Harry just kind of was like, oh, thanks so much. And I was like, you're welcome. And
that was
we sort
it.
Of left at that. And then I moved overseas. I moved to the UK and I was lying on a beach in Greece and I was a little bit drunk and I was kind of bored because, you know, like, laying on a beach in Greece is just not enough these days. And I was just scrolling and Harry had posted some story and I was like, I'm going to reply to him. And I just shot some generic reply, but then the conversation never stopped. Like, that was kind of where it cracked on.
Turned to 5-hour FaceTimes till five a.m. in the morning in Australia time, so I was up all night. And then, that was 3 months of doing that, really, talking every single day. And, Belle was living this wonderful life. I said, when are you going to come back? Belle said, I'm not. And I said, well, I guess I'll have to come and see you. So I bought a plane ticket to Italy to meet Belle and Ray.
Yeah.
And
that Italy looks cheap. Let's go.
So you'd literally gone from 3 months of FaceTiming messaging nonstop to then meeting for the first time in real life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was, everyone in my hostel in Albania, like, knew that, like, we joked, like, Bella's going to meet her husband, like, like, Bella's going on a date, and, like, this girl that was traveling, like, gave me, like, a skirt she didn't want anymore, and everyone was, like, crowdsourcing dresses from the lost property for me. We went to, like, this secondhand flea market in Albania and bought me some, like, new underwear. Everybody, like, Instagram has never let me live down that I bought secondhand underwear. But, like, they were really clean. And so I was like, yeah, I'm ready to go meet this man. And, yeah, I posted on my, like, close friends. I was like, going to meet my husband in Italy. And then turns out, like, it was pretty true. We met in Rome and...
But we did say we'll give the 4 days the gap, but we didn't leave each other's side after
It was so fun.
It was the best time.
Yeah.
Darn.
And I remember Belle opened the door and she was had this tanned olive skin.
So tanned.
This denim, like... It was like a denim vest.
Yeah, I still own it.
And this flower skirt, and she just glowed and was so beautiful and just so gorgeous. And I opened the door. We gave a little, like, it was like an awkward peck on the cheek, on the lip, sorry. And then we went to dinner down the road.
Half cheek, half lip.
Yep.
Yeah. A couple of Aperols, we were sweet.
Yeah. It always is.
Yeah, it always is. Yeah, it's always the case.
And so you had, obviously, Belle, already known about Harry's advocacy. But at what point did you guys talk about your experiences growing up, Harry?
We didn't really, did we? I mean, it was mentioned in conversation here and there, but it was never like a big chat, what people would expect, I think.
No, I think...
It wasn't like a big sit down.
Yeah, I think there's sort of this idea, if you're dating someone that's had like significant trauma, that it's this elephant in the room or whatever. But it you know, I've had a lot of trauma in my life too that I've spoken about, from things that have happened to me when I was a teenager too, and, you know, just general female trauma. But it's kind of just comes out as you get to know each other, like any normal relationship. And, you know, you have a conversation about this and it ties into this, and you talk about your parents and you talk about your family and you talk about the good things and the bad things. And yeah, there was a time when we were on that island where we were talking about Harry's daughter who was born from his abuse, and she lives overseas and we don't know where she is. And I just said, I kind of just had this moment where I just was like, you know, I accept you. Like, I accept you for everything, and I accept that you have a daughter, and I accept all of this, and I just want you to know that. Like, I'm in it for everything, I guess.
And I think people have this idea, or people tend to ask me, did Bella heal you? And the answer is no.
Nah.
Because, but it was, healing was always my responsibility. Healing is not Bella's responsibility. But Bella created an environment where healing could be, it was a safe space for me to heal.
I pushed you a bit.
Yeah. Well, yeah, in the best way possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd never been to Europe before. It was my first time in Europe. I'd never traveled like that. It was like you opened my world to so many new opportunities.
Yeah. And I'm a Scorpio. I just go in guns blazing. And, like, I took Harry to go renovate a house, like, on our first date, like, with my best friend in Sicily.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, this is my best friend, so we're going to knock down this wall today. Like, get on with it. Let's go. And, I even thought later, I was like, should I be more gentle with him? Like, you know, like, because people ask me, they're like, what's it like dating someone who's been through child sexual abuse? And I'm like, well, I don't really fucking think about it. Like, excuse my language. He's just Harry.
But you never tried to rescue me either.
God, no. You don't need rescuing.
Yeah, you never tried to rescue me. You just loved me in a way where I was just accepted as a human being.
There's something about, like, this is my first secure relationship where I've actually had that not anxious attachment, because in the past, I've had really up and down relationships where I've always been on edge. And this was just the first time where I've just been completely safe. And I think in that safe place, it is really transformative, but it's not relying on the other person. It just puts you in a place to be able to heal and grow and nurture yourself in a sense.
Like, I think we've done that for each other.
Yeah, I think so.
You just create this space where, like, I know that Belle accepts me warts and all. But she doesn't see me for the warts. She sees me for Harry.
You don't have the warts.
Neither do you.
I can't, you guys. I literally just even looking at you both now, it's so, so obvious that you're both just so in love with each other, and it's so beautiful.
Uh-huh.
Harry, how does that feel, like, having had, you know, your earliest experiences of quote-unquote love being taught to you as something that was it was abusive, but being taught to you that that was love, right? Like the coercive and manipulation around what your stepmother did was around saying that it was love. But now obviously being in something that is so healthy and safe and secure, what's that experience been like for you?
Well, it's definitely interesting because the abuse that I experienced, it does replicate dynamics of normal adult relationships. And that's not to say that, you know, what we go through is abuse at all. What we go through is loving and beautiful. But the dynamic in the abuse that really carried out, and I hate using the word relationship when I'm trying to describe the abuse I experienced because that's not what it was at all. It was abuse. But in order for people to understand what that dynamic was like, it was like a regular relationship for all those years. You know, I remember whenever my father would leave the house and my stepmother and I would be there with our daughter, we would just pretend to be happy families and cook and, you know, I'd go to the grocery store and bring nappies back. It was like just a normal dynamic. So I think coming into this relationship where it has been really healthy and really beautiful, but there has been triggers that have arisen throughout periods of it because unintentionally our relationship has maybe replicated a certain dynamic. But I know I'm allowed to voice that, and Bella accepts it and goes, okay, reassures me and goes, okay, listen, that's not what this is. This is, you know, X, Y, Z. Do you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And like, you know, some things also trigger, like I find it very hard to hear like
my story,
Harry's parts of Harry's story. Like, to be honest, I'm going to admit something really horrible on here, but I haven't read all of Harry's book because I'm not, pregnancy has been really hard and like your mental health is up and down. I'm like, if I read this, it could actually break me for a little while.
Yeah.
But you know, we live it. So I feel like I get props for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny. Like I think anyone coming to any relationship will have triggers. Like we're all kind of products of our past. And I also have them too. Like I'm a bit of a control freak and like protect my independence. Like a crazy witch.
Don't worry about me.
And so, yeah, it's always just, we're just always learning about each other. And I think we got engaged after 6 months, which sounds so Mormon, but like we're not religious. We weren't even living together when we got engaged.
No.
Like we got engaged in the kitchen of the house that I worked in.
I bought the ring and it was burning a hole in my pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah, it needed to.
And I think about us now, like we got engaged 18 months ago and like I just feel like I know you on such a deeper level now as well. And whilst I thought I knew you so well then, like we've gone through so much in the last 18 months, it's like I know you right to like your lava core.
Yeah. Same.
And I just think that's the beautiful thing about the way Harry is and how honest Harry is about everything. You know, he's put everything out in a book, but he's like put everything out with me first.
I think to build on what you're saying, we get it wrong as well.
Oh, we get it
wrong all the time. And like, but we give each other enough resistance to understand that but the other person's probably going to fuck up because, you know, like that's just the nature of the game.
And do you know what else we actually do? If we call it having beef, if we're beefing, if we're like fighting a little bit, we actually try to fight in funny voices.
Yeah, we do.
We have accents, which we're not going to do on here. It's a kind of thing. But they're not like horrible accents. Yeah. It's like just quite funny. It just takes all the like harshness out of things. Like if like the harsh truths, maybe if we're really annoyed at something someone's done, if you say it in an accent, it's actually not that harsh.
Yeah.
I love you guys. That is so funny.
That's my relationship too.
But like,
it's
like,
really funny.
You know that guy on TikTok that goes, "Hello, points us."
Yeah.
We do that voice.
I don't want anyone thinking we're doing anything racist.
No. Don't worry.
It's the points us guy.
Yeah, points us.
Peep and I do the same.
Cool.
I love that though because that's the thing. It's like I love how you frame it, Belle, because we are all humans. We all have past. We are all going to have triggers. Like that's just, and sometimes relationships actually bring out the worst of them because you're actually having to confront, you know, a dynamic that you have, like you said, Harry, from your past. But really excitingly now, you are going to be parents. Well,
yes.
Bella for the first time, but you for the second. Mm-hmm. And how are you navigating that? I guess, like, you know, the stereotype is quote unquote breaking that cycle. But what are some things that you're thinking about being an intentional parent for the second time?
As I was sort of touching on before, when it comes to healing, it's a similar sort of dynamic where you're not coming up with this foul swooping motion of breaking a cycle. It is these intentional things that you you know, these intentional small decisions that you make on a regular basis. And it's like apologizing when you say the wrong thing, or, you know, not being as stubborn in your views when you're, you know, trying to have a contest of ideas like we do in our house.
We do.
But it's being able to unpack that with someone who sees me and has seen the worst parts of me, but also the best parts of me, and loves me no matter what, and vice versa. I think that's been such a beautiful environment to be able to foster that. And I know with my first daughter, the love I have for my eldest daughter, it doesn't erase because this baby's coming into the world. I love her with all my heart and with nothing but abundance. And this beautiful girl on the way doesn't change that. But I know that this baby that Bella and I are bringing into the world, or Bella's bringing into the world, I should say. It's Bella.
But, very clear about that.
But I think she's just going to be brought into such a loving and beautiful environment that Bella and I have really worked hard to establish as well. We put a lot of hard work into this dynamic and this understanding we have of each other. So I think this kid is just going to have the coolest mum in the world.
Coolest parents in the whole world.
We're both cool. Thanks.
Yeah. You're cooler.
It's crazy. Like, I didn't expect to lose myself in pregnancy so much. I think people really talk about when you have a baby, how hard it is afterwards, like leaving the house, etc. But for me, I just had such a revisit of all my trauma. So I, like, just for context, I had cancer when I was younger, and a lot of medical misogyny I experienced, and a lot of gaslighting of symptoms, and also just a lot of throwing up and being unwell and being confined to bed. And so that's pretty much exact, like, cancer and pregnancy were really strangely aligned in my brain and my body. And so I think my body just, like, went back to this place.
Well, I remember you described it once as
something
growing within you that you couldn't control.
Yeah.
And pregnancy and, like, cancer is a similar thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I ended up speaking to my mum about it. And my mum and I have a good relationship now, but we didn't when I was younger because of how sick I was. And sometimes you forget, like, your parents were people. It's so easy to forget. And my mum said that when she was pregnant with me, she had a complex relationship with her father, and she sat him down and she just said, like, all the things that he did to her that traumatized her as a child and a teenager. And then she said, "I forgive you." And, you know, like, my grandfather actually listened, and he, like, took it on board, and they worked out their relationship from there. And I just, like, I never knew my mum did that. And I just thought that was that's kind of how pregnancy feels. It's like everything comes to the surface and you don't know what to do with it. Like,
yeah.
It's like physical, but also, I guess, like, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, because you're having to think about yourself in a lineage, right? And, like, generationally, it changes your perspective, because I feel like, as well, just Western wise, we grow up quite individualistic, and then having a baby changes things.
You
start thinking about your parents and their parents and the things that are generational trauma that's passed down, or the dynamics and relationships and what you might want to keep and what you might want to not keep.
But also, I think trauma isn't just about what happened to you. It's about the weight you place on what happened to you as well. And I think we've been able to really come to this understanding that we're more than what we went through. And that's what's been so beautiful about the dynamic and the life that we have now. Yeah.
I love that, guys. You are both so inspiring. And this has been such an honor and a pleasure, not only just reading your incredible book, Harry, but also just being Instagram internet friends.
In those DMs.
But getting to know you both on a deeper level now. So I really appreciate you being so honest and authentic and showing up today and for sharing your stories. Thank you.
Oh, we adore you, Dee. Thanks for having us.